Got a lot to talk about today, theoretically.
I love theories. All right.
Theories?
Yes, theories.
You want to go right into follow-up?
Yes. Thanks to Mike very much for being on our wonderful little show thing. That was very nice of him. And we're really sad that we weren't able to cancel our podcast per his request, but we'll try to do better next time. Does that about sum up your feelings?
Yeah, pretty much. It was okay. Fun.
Yeah.
He sounded way better than us, so I had to like mess his audio up a little bit in the mix, so we all sounded equal.
Oh, yeah. You can't have somebody from Great Britain going around making it sound bad with their fancy accent. But
I did listen to a bit of Unprofessional to see what he was talking about with Whiskas, and I guess I get it with the way he talks fast, the way I talk fast when I'm rambling about things, and some of the I knows and you means and whatevers that I say. I don't know.
Okay. You know. All right.
What do you think Dave Whiskas would make of this VFX reference platform fac?
I don't think he would care.
I don't think we care either.
I don't. Yeah. Well, no, but the... I saw that... I follow the former CTO of ImageWorks had retweeted that. And so I saw it and I was reading up on it and I was like, this really doesn't answer any of the questions we had. And all of our conjecture about how it wouldn't even really matter for us was kind of there. Like it doesn't matter for us. It's not, most of the questions were like, where can we get our hands on this? And the answers were, you can't. It's not a thing.
Because it's not a thing yet.
Yeah. How
can I get certified? Well, we don't really certify, but you can put a label on your product if you abide by these fake rules that we've made up.
Yeah, it's like, well, this is mostly just for Autodesk and SideFX and Foundry. So the rest of you guys, just don't worry about it.
Wait, who is SideFX again? What do they make?
Houdini.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like pretty much everything in here was, unless you work at a major studio or you make software, this has nothing to do with anything that you'll ever encounter.
Bingo.
All right. So, mm-hmm. Reference platform done.
Yeah, questions asked.
I love the Python one, too. Will the reference platform move to Python 3? Well, backwards compatibility really won't work, so that's a tricky question. Like, half of these frequently asked questions, the answer is just, we don't know yet.
Well, no, but the thing that I found amusing about that is they should know that there will never be Python 2.6 and 2.7 backwards compatibility. So saying that they'll see if they're able to do that, if backwards compatibility can be kept, it's like, oh, then no, it's never happening. So what's the point of even, I don't know, just say no.
Seems like somebody whipped this FAQ together in a hurry a month late.
Mm-hmm. It's like, just answer no to most of these and you're fine. But they went through the trouble of writing some long wishy-washy statements, but that's hardly that exciting.
Yeah. In other terrible VFX news, how about this Stereo D news? Do we have much to say other than the fact that this is another company moving to Vancouver?
No, nothing much to say. I mean, in their announcement, they're like, we anticipate to move all of these positions and not lose any people, which was a really curious statement to make, since the very nature of closing jobs here and opening jobs there is that you will technically lose jobs.
Unless they're paying for the relocations. It seems like they're being rather optimistic about what percentage of their staff would be willing to move to Canada for this.
Well, that and technically, I think if it's set up like some of these other companies, they have a separate company process in the other country. So it's like a satellite of the main company. So you technically do get rehired by another entity. So
isn't that the point of most of these subsidies? You have to do your business within the country, which kind of means you have to hire local people?
Well, yeah, but they've been getting around that for years. Because it's one of those things where you tell a bunch of local politicians, like, oh, think of what jobs this will bring. And then you just kind of look the other... They kind of look the other way while you hire in all these other people. And you're like, oh, well, we really need them.
Really what it does is pay some apartment complexes and some local restaurants for the duration of a movie.
Yeah. And well, I mean, they do hope to keep some of these people on for a long time, but I heard reports of people getting like 3-year visa approvals for 4-month projects, you know, a few years ago. So I don't think that's still happening. I heard there was like a bit of a crackdown on that. But it's another one of those things where it's just, you know, convince a municipality to pay for something because it'll bring so much money to the area, when really, you know, the thing that you could do to bring the most amount of money to the area would be to get the executives to move there. Yeah, but it's annoying. And like North Carolina apparently had a film incentive program, subsidy program, that I was completely unaware of because I don't think I even know of anything that was made in North Carolina. But they're going from like $60 million down to $10 million. And of course, the threat is, well, then we won't be able to make stuff in your state anymore because that's just too low for us to be able to do it. And so it's one of those things where it's like, once you get locked into the paying for these jobs that, you know, print money or whatever, then you're paying for the rest of eternity. And you will not be able to scale back on your incentives that you're offering.
This is going to be a pretty VFX heavy episode, but maybe we could move on to something slightly less terrible. What about, I've got the Deadpool footage as our next item of follow-up to talk about.
Yeah, so that leaked. So that's interesting. And I think you told me that it was made a while ago.
Yeah, I saw some mention from a VFX artist on Twitter that it was made, what, about 3 years ago, and they were concerned or confused why it was coming out now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I think the development period for when they would have had Ryan Reynolds testing out some motion capture stuff to potentially lead a feature film, that would have been a few years ago before
Green Lantern.
Before Green Lantern got it tanked, that idea. Yeah. But, you know, did you see the behind-the-scenes still that was him in the mocap suit on a set?
Yes, I did, sitting on the box, which I assume is for the opening part where he's listening to Gwen Stefani. But I wasn't... Like, it's clearly just a test of like whether or not they could do this technically for what they wanted, because they were going to just go with a complete digital replacement for Ryan Reynolds. And
why not? Because Deadpool rarely ever takes his costume off, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, I didn't see much benefit to doing that. Because it allowed them to do more expressive stuff with his face and his eyes than if he was wearing makeup. But because obviously, if you had actually put fabric over his face, he wouldn't have had those eye lines that move like that. And he wouldn't have had nearly as good of a read on his mouth as what they had for through the like whatever that latexy looking fabric is they used or made it look like for that. Like, they wouldn't have, it wouldn't have been as emotive, but at the same time, that also makes it feel uncanny. I'm not really sure why that was a good idea, but I felt the same way about Green Lantern, where it's like, I don't know why this is a good idea, guys. Like, it's a lot of digital stuff, and it doesn't really look like a person, so.
They could do a Watchmen Rorschach thing, I guess, if they wanted to enhance his face and just make the rest of it live action, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, and people have done that, you know, for a really long time now. It's just enhance the makeup effects digitally. But I got to assume that it's because it was the head of Blur that was doing the test that he wanted to go, like, as crazy with the VFX as possible because he's a VFX supervisor. But
Blur doesn't do a whole lot of mixing with live action stuff, do they?
No, well, they typically do like game trailers and stuff, but they have started doing more film things. And it's not to slight them. I think they do a really good job.
They're great.
Yeah, and I think that the only problem with the Deadpool stuff is just that it's a little uncanny. You know, so it's not great. It doesn't feel like it reads like it was totally required that they do it that way.
Yeah, it was also, it felt very slapsticky, and I think part of that had to do with the sort of wall-to-wall Ryan Reynolds gab fest that was going on. Like, he never shut up at all, even when he was getting punched in the face or when he was diving off of the bridge or whatever. And I, you know, for a test, I guess it doesn't make a huge difference, but if he's literally just going to be rambling, silly dialogue for an entire movie, that would get old real fast. And it just doesn't, that's not a thing somebody would do.
Well, but that's kind of, it goes with the Deadpool character though, is because it is over the top like that, and he is constantly saying crazy, inappropriate, fourth wall breaking things. But that's also probably why they haven't felt compelled to make a Deadpool movie yet.
Maybe if there was somebody in this that he was actually talking to, it wouldn't have been quite so uncanny, but he was just talking aloud to himself, probably to remind us that it was Ryan Reynolds in the suit.
Yeah, but that would have happened in the movie, because he works by himself. He's not on, like, a team or anything.
I thought I saw panels of him hanging out with Wolverine and stuff.
Well, sometimes they, like, pair off and do stuff together, but they're not... If you're making a Deadpool movie, you wouldn't be making a Deadpool movie with Wolverine.
Hmm.
Yeah. Anyway... I mean, well, it is Fox, so they could do it because they own the rights to both characters.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're moving right along. Do we have anything to say about Ant-Man? There's more of that come out. You sent me that article about the character that was surreptitiously removed from the Avengers entirely.
Well, the Wasp. I'm not a huge fan of like old Avengers history or anything, so I'm not really up to speed on everything about the Wasp, or Hank Pym for that matter, who the Ant-Man. I'm not super invested, but I did think it's weird that they have a shortage of female characters in these movies, and it seemed peculiar to wipe her aside. That article also specifically went into detail about Edgar Wright leaving the project and how people don't have scripts yet and they're going to film in 2 weeks. So it's, you know, it seems like that movie's a bit of a mess, to put it mildly. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, this is sort of the downside of the Disney Central Control Authority process, is that the auteurs kind of get crushed under it if they don't go along with all the stuff, and if they do get crushed under it, then they still have to make the movie anyways, so they're going to rush something in. So I don't know what it's going to be, but good luck, guys.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hear more about it after the movie comes out, what was changed at the last minute, but right now I just feel so bad for the pre-production team if they don't have a finalized script, and if this movie is as VFX intensive as any of the other ones are have been. They're probably tearing their hair out, because how do you prep for something 2 weeks out without having a script? You just can't.
Well, supposedly they've lost heads of departments and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's not even like they're all waiting, or that they're staffed with people waiting for the scripts. Like, this is...
So it's got, Ant-Man is going to be another Alien 3, basically.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, we'll have to see when it comes out, but like, they kept Paul Rudd, But that doesn't really mean anything because Paul Rudd's not making the sets. I'm assuming that they're not going to change major set pieces off of the Edgar Wright draft because they just won't be able to. That it'll mostly be dialogue or things they film on certain sets. But
There's a lot of digital set replacement and they'll shoot it green screen, they'll probably say screw it and figure it out later, as often happens.
Well, it's going to have a lot of green screen because he shrinks. And yeah. I don't know if you know this, but we don't really have the technology to do that practically.
Unless you're...
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
I was just going to say...
This big,
I was going to say, unless you're shooting pencils. The Hobbit, in which case you can do these stupid motion control sets with one set that's too big and one set that's too small and marry the camera moves together. Mm. That camera setup was too complicated to even try and explain, even if I had like little action figures in my hand. But the only thing I wanted to say about this... the cutting out of the Wasp thing. If she was indeed a founding member of the Avengers, would she not have had to have her own solo movie ahead of time to sort of, before they got into the Avengers, to kind of make that make sense?
No, here's the thing, is they've already had the Avengers movie, so whether or not she's a founding member doesn't really matter anymore. Just the fact that she wouldn't have any presence at all, even though she has a large presence in the comic book, I think is what people object to. But like I said, I don't have the personal knowledge of her whole comic history, because it goes, you know, way back.
I just wonder if when they were still trying to build the franchise to find out even if the Avengers was going to work, or if it was just going to be a couple one-off solo movies that failed, they didn't really have the production or the money to put behind a character that lesser people knew about or didn't really have any idea why she was having her own solo movie ahead of time. Or, I mean, because you can't just, if she's a founding member, you can't really just have her show up in the Avengers movie and be like, well, I was here all along, right?
Well, no, but see, that's what I'm getting at, though, is like, they wouldn't have had her be a founding member. She still would have been a comic book character in the franchise somewhere. Like, just not having her at all seems like a very drastic position to shift to, from her being a founding member in the comic books to not being present, to being dead before the events of the Ant-Man movie.
I suppose, being an outsider to this, the comic world, I would think leaving her out so you could come back later would do more justice potentially in the future than sort of half-assing a character into something just because you felt it needed to be there for fan service. But
no, but she's not going to be in it ever because she's dead. She's written in as a dead character. So it's not like they're going to like come back to it later.
She is actually written into one of the scripts as a dead character.
Yeah, in the Ant-Man movie, she's apparently died before the events of the movie. So
right.
That's what I'm getting at, is like, you know, you go from her being a founding member and important in the comics to her not being there at all ever, or any chance for her to ever be there. So that's a really peculiar choice, I think.
I think the idea of making an Ant-Man movie in general is a peculiar choice.
Well, they've done Stranger Things.
Unless, for some reason, in Ant-Man's quadrant of whatever universe he lives in, they have some sort of glowy little rock that fits into a larger narrative, which, again, we will get back to in a minute.
Well, okay. Do you want me to tell you what he's most famous for in the comics?
Yes, what is Ant-Man famous for?
Well, beating his wife, and then... who is the Wasp. So I guess that's probably also why she's dead.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he the reason she's dead?
No, I hope not. That'd be really dark.
That would be a really dark turn for the Marvel franchise in this whatever second section of the series they're talking about.
Yeah, but if you look up the stuff on their relationship, it's really kind of messed up. And he got kicked out of the Avengers when that happened and stuff like that. And it was like back in the late 70s, I think, that they had that storyline. That was really a peculiar choice that they decided to go with that. So he's not a nice person, but he also made the robot Ultron, which, as you've seen from the Avengers 2 stuff, Ultron is going to be the robot adversary that they will be fighting in that.
So Ant-Man made the bad guy for Avengers 2? What?
Yes. And that's why Ant-Man is going to be coming out around the same time as Avengers 2. Because...
All right.
Reasons.
Whatever. Sure. Yeah. The one thing I was going to say about that is we've seen, based on Guardians of the Galaxy, which we'll talk about again in a minute, they're fine with throwing away the first little bit of a franchise and sort of going with the later reboot, as noted by the father storyline of Guardians character, main character. Did you read anything about that, the original storyline?
You mean the original comic storyline of Peter Quill?
Yeah.
But I have to say, I wasn't aware of it before reading that. I knew about the second version of his origin story after. That was what I was most familiar with, even though I'm barely familiar with the characters at all.
Yeah. Anyway, last little bits of follow-up. Spider-Man 3 pushed to 2018.
Yep.
Basically, this is writing on the wall signifying that it may never happen, or at least at the very minimum, Andrew Garfield will be replaced and it may be a reboot again.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably the most likely outcome, because I think Andrew Garfield's gonna be like 35 or something by 2018.
Yeah, and they said they replaced Tobey Maguire at like 33 or something.
Yeah, so it seems unlikely he's going to be playing a high schooler at 35. And I know
Stranger Things have happened.
Well, I know they graduated and all that jazz, but seems like a very large gap.
I don't want to speak for the rest of the movie-going audience, but I don't know that I would personally tolerate another reboot.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but there are a lot of people who aren't really convinced it was a reboot, like my mom, who I've tried to explain this to on several occasions, because she would ask what I was doing, and I would tell her that I was working on something, and then I would tell her that it was, you know, a reboot of the Spider-Man movie. And then she would say, oh, you mean it happens before the other movies? And I said, no. And she'd be like, well, so it's a sequel then? And I'm like, no, it's the other movies didn't happen in that continuity. It's a totally different continuity. And she'd be like, oh, okay. And then we'd have that conversation like 6 more times.
Would she see it and then go like, why is he getting bit by a spider again? I thought he already had the thing.
Yes. And see, like, that's a thing is like, it was kind of pointless to have an origin story movie for him again. I mean, I know they want to have like the mystery of his parents and stuff, and so that's why they did it, but whatever. I think it confused audiences more because a lot of people still have it in their heads that they liked the Raimi movies, and that they weren't really expecting a reboot. I like Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it just a lot of people were kind of thinking that it was a sequel still, and it's very much not. And so I think by pushing it to 2018, and they're going to be quite aged at that point, and there's going to be such a large gap in the events going on, I don't see anything else other than it being rebooted again. And the fact that they have the Sinister Six movie coming out before it, and they have the Venom movie slated to come out before it, even though I think they've done some musical chairs with directors and stuff on those, you know, so who knows what'll wind up happening. But that's going to be really strange. So good luck, guys, trying to like come up with your movie about villains and then rebooting your franchise 2 years later.
Yeah, I don't think we need an origin story for Spider-Man anymore.
No, but
they should move on, just like Wolverine, and go on to telling terrible stories that take place in Tokyo for no reason.
No, I was going to say they should just do like what they did with the Hulk and just have, you know, another actor just show up being Spider-Man. And then that would be fine. No one would care. And then,
hey guys, I'm Christian Bale, also Spider-Man.
Well, a little old.
Yeah, well. Spider-Man gets older eventually, I assume.
Well, but then they kind of just reset him, whatever that happens, and he goes back. Like, he got old and had a kid and married and everything, and then he made a deal with the devil to not have that life. So
maybe that's what they're doing, very sort of slowly. They're capping
deal with Spider-Man
and rebooting over and over again. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They're never letting him get old enough into that. They're just rebooting it because that's what they do in the comics, apparently.
God, it's so stupid. Like, whenever you read stuff about Spider-Man's recent, like, history of the last 20 years or something, like, the major plot points in his life, it's like, he was cloned. The clone pretended to be him for a while. He had his aunt die, come back to life, made deal with the devil, got married, had a baby, exposed his identity to the world. Then the world forgot his identity. I mean, just like all kinds of crazy shit.
I guess the biggest part I just took out of that is in Spider-Man's storyline, there's a devil?
In the Marvel Universe, there are demons, and there's one called Mephisto, who's basically the devil.
Oh, I remember him. I had his trading card or whatever.
You collected trading cards?
Nerd. I totally had Marvel cards when I was a kid. They're probably still in the attic somewhere, ruined from the heat.
With the foil back and stuff like that?
I think so. Yeah.
I didn't have any of those, but I had a friend who had the Phoenix ones and the X-Men stuff, and I was like, oh, this is so cool. I had
a binder of them.
Oh, God. Dan. Why couldn't you just collect comic books like a normal person?
Because I didn't really have a comic book shop, and I don't remember where the cards came from. Probably the grocery store, like everything else.
Yeah.
Baseball cards with that terrible gum in it.
Well, they used to have comic books at the grocery store. Like, they'd have a periodical magazine section, and they would have some comic books in there. It was totally random what they would have. And so you'd like pick up something that was the third in an arc of 4 comic books, and that would be the only book that you would have from that entire series that they would have in that grocery store. So you kind of had to go on that.
Yeah, I think the last comic book I purchased was at a record store that was going out of business. Yes, an actual vinyl record store. It was a Wolverine comic. It was something where he got like toxic sludge on him, and he suddenly had like claws coming out of every part of his body. Like, he had like 80 spikes coming out of him, and he was like rabid and attacking random people. I couldn't tell you what it was at this point.
That's
it wasn't very interesting. Okay. I think he was cured by the end of the 10-page book or whatever it was.
Oh, good for him. But yeah, I mean, comic books are a mess. But that kind of takes I think we should segue into a discussion of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes. Came out this weekend.
Yes.
It's already capped $100 million in revenue, I think.
Should we... We don't have a spoiler horn. Can you just make like a crow sound? Just like caw-caw, you know? Like, just as a warning?
I'll put something. But before we get to spoilers, you want to just give your basic non-spoilery opinion of the movie? Or can you not say anything without spoiling?
No, I could say it. I think if people watched The Avengers and they liked it a lot, then I think they'll definitely like Guardians of the Galaxy. I think it has a lot of really good things in it. It has some story things that I have problems with, and we'll talk about those in the spoilers.
Yeah, I agree. It was entertaining. It was fine. It was a good, mostly well-made movie. I enjoyed it for not really knowing any of these characters ahead of time. That's about all I have to say before we get into spoilers.
Yeah. It's hard to say anything that you really do or do not like about it without, you know.
Yeah. I encourage people to go see it because it was fun. It's a big summer blockbuster. A lot of stuff blows up. You know, it's entertaining.
And the visual effects are good.
Most of them.
Oh, Dan. No, you didn't.
I have one bone to pick on that.
Uh-huh.
The only thing I was going to say is in this storyline, his origin story, did you know his dad's name is Jason?
Yes, like Jason of Spartax.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, so spoiler horn now. And we're done. All right, so do you want to just like walk through it from the start and kind of... I guess just talk it through kind of like we did with World War Z. Is that a good way to go about this?
Oh yeah, I came fully prepared for this.
All right. Well, the one thing I wanted to say is I really liked the beginning. The tone of it was different. It was serious. I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy watching his mom die of cancer, presumably.
You monster.
No, I didn't like that at all, obviously. But it was a very serious tone, and I understood that, you know, instant bond with the character. You understand where he's coming from and what he's all about. And then the other thing right at the beginning of the movie that I thought was great and had a great tone was Ronan's introduction was ominous and scary. And as a character, I really, like, I was intrigued. He was frightening. I liked watching it. At the very end of that scene, I was a little less into his character when he basically just hit a guy in the head with a big hammer. But his whole like coming out of the goop and putting on the ceremonial makeup and the garb or whatever, I thought that whole buildup was interesting. And his whole, religious, political reasons for wanting to kill everyone was fine. I got where he was coming from. He's this radical psychopath who's going to... Here's what he's about, and here's what he's gonna do for the rest of the movie. And I understood it, and he was scary. And I thought the rest of the movie kind of did a disservice to that opening scene because he got more nonsensical and less scary, and they kind of took the power and fear out of him at some points. But do you have any thoughts on that before we just go scene by scene through it?
I feel the opposite about the beginning. I thought that it was... very much kind of a cliche, like, here's your bad guy preparing himself, like, monologuing the whole thing. Like, I would much rather have seen him do things than seen him get dressed and monologue about
his
thoughts.
That can kind of be said about the entire movie and his character.
Well, yeah, but I mean, and I'll come back to this later, too, is like, I feel like this movie a lot of times says things instead of doing them, which is strange because it does a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They do put a lot of stuff on screen, so it's not like they say everything, but this is one of those things where it's like, I never got a clear sense of his personal story about why he felt this way. I understood that he had these feelings. I never saw anything like, oh, well, this is, you know, his battle from before with, you know, the Nova Corps or something like that. Like, this is his reason for hating the Xandarian so much, or this is his reason for rebelling against the Kree and going off on his own thing. And it's like, I never got that. I only got, like, he was a rebel, and I got that he didn't like the Xandarians and the Nova Corps and wanted to eliminate them from the face of the galaxy no matter what the cost. But that seems a little extreme in light of the fact that we never saw anything about why they wronged him.
Yeah, I guess I forgave that opening monologue because exposition in the beginning of the movie happens all the time, and that's generally kind of an acceptable thing to do to a certain extent. But after
Thor
that,
well,
yes, yeah, as you pointed out in your article that we'll put in the show notes, there was a ton of that. But, you know, getting his background would have taken an entire movie just to see all of that stuff. And as to if anyone were actually as angry as he was, he would need his own movie or two to explain all that. But I was okay with that exposition in the beginning. But yeah, as we moved further and further into the movie, it was just, I was getting fatigue from, okay, the score turns into a little soft, sad music. Somebody's going to monologue for about 5 minutes. And then at the end of that scene, somebody is going to make a joke about it and we're going to cut. And just that, it was just repeatable, repeatable, repeatable. It was predictable pretty much what was going to happen. And they would have a dramatic monologue for a moment. And then one of the other characters would make a joke, or there would be a sight gag that would just completely counter what just happened. And then they would cut and move on. And that drove me nuts repeatedly. Every time it would happen and I would hear that score change, I would just drop my head against the chair and just say, okay, is he done yet? All right, we're moving along now.
No, well, I think some of that had to do with hiring Tyler Bates for the score. I'm never impressed with his work.
So we open on the hospital.
Yeah.
Kid's mom dies.
Mm-hmm.
He runs outside.
Bambi's mom is dead.
He runs outside and is immediately picked up by a spaceship.
Yeah, and see, I think that they could have done a better job of explaining the motivation for why Yondu never delivered the abducted child, but
the fact that explanation comes like in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Well, they very briefly say something about it towards the beginning when he initially rebels against Yondu by not bringing him the sphere. But that's getting a little far ahead. So let's talk about him putting on his headphones and then beating up some alien rat things. And he hopscotches his way over to the sphere thing and puts down a special little device and retrieves it. It's all neat. And then we see the first introduction to the bad guys, who are incredibly incompetent.
He is a member, or has been for a while, a member of a group called the Ravagers, which sounds like they originally went with Scavengers, but they didn't think it was cool enough, so they just changed the name. That's me coming from knowing nothing about these people.
Mm-hmm.
So well, he goes Indiana Jones with like a little doohickey that he just throws on the floor that sucks this little magic orb out of its force field or whatever, and then he has like a 2-second battle and flies out a window.
Mm-hmm.
Or a hole in the wall, I should say.
Yeah. And then we see he has a spaceship, and he leaves. And we see that he's not particularly caring about women in his life.
well, we also, we skipped over, there are a few pop culture references, aside from his, I do enjoy the soundtrack as sort of a standalone thing. It seems a little kind of on the nose. A lot of this thing seems on the nose, but he's got his little tape of 70s and 80s jams that his mom made for him that he's carrying around and we're listening to. But then he calls one of the bad guys a Ninja Turtle because, you know, that's where he's from, and, you know, they kind of look like, I don't know, faceless Ninja Turtle monsters. Anyway, but yes, he's back on his ship. He's a bit of a womanizer because he forgot that his fling is hanging out on his spaceship as he's trying to evade capture or being blown up.
Yeah. And then we get the little phone call with Yondu, where she answers the phone and she's not supposed to. And he's like, oh, I'm going to betray you. Sorry about that. No big deal. I'm going to sell directly to the broker instead of going back to you so you can sell to the broker.
Can we take a minute to talk about the word betray? Because it's used like 30 times in this movie, and I don't think any of them really understand what that word means.
Well, I mean, it is treachery. I mean, it's you know, not like the worst thing in the world, but I mean, yeah, theoretically, for the amount of money he'd be getting off of it, then I guess it's
great. All right, I'll get back to that when we talk about Gamora.
He did steal a ship because it's not really his ship.
Well, at the end of the movie, it's his ship.
Well, but not at the beginning. But yeah, so they say that whole thing and go to you know, introduce Gamora and Nebula, and they have that conversation with Ronan where he's just like, oh, I need my sphere. Go to Xandar, because I don't know why I know it's there, and go get the sphere from whoever has it, and you go, Nebula, and Gamora's all like, no, I'm going to do it, because, like, I'll take care of it. And then you get the whole, like, tension of one of them wants to do it, the other one doesn't want to do it, and that's it. No explanation.
It's these two stepdaughters of Thanos who have been loaned out for reasons, who now work for Ronan for... again, no, not entirely sure why.
Well,
they're listening to him, or they've been hanging out with him.
They work with him because they are, because Thanos has promised to help Ronan destroy the Zandarians as long as he gets the sphere thing for him.
Yeah, but how do they fit into that?
Because they're there to help him.
okay, but why? Just because Dad said so?
Yeah, I mean, like, they're his. You know, he like sends his contractors out. They're like, make sure this happens. And they do a terrible
job
of that.
For children who, from the beginning of the movie, are supposed to be quote-unquote loyal to their father, they both go, screw this guy, pretty immediately.
Well, yes. Although Nebula probably sticks out the longest for not screwing him over. I don't know. I wouldn't have sent Gamora. That seemed a little suspicious. But it's a good thing they did, because then we have the charming moment where he goes to try to sell it to the broker, and he's all like, oh, you talk to Ronan, I don't want any part of this, and kicks him out. And then Gamora's like, I'm gonna just steal this thing, and she's eating like a fruit or something.
Yeah,
and kicks and his butt.
We should have prefaced this in the beginning that this whole conversation here is me in particular, probably you a little bit too, completely overthinking the plot, but that's just a thing I do because I want the movie to make sense. So we're going to talk about things that probably don't matter too much to most people. But okay, so he tries to sell it to the dealer guy,
mm-hmm.
who won't tell him who his buyer is, but then he hears that Ronan is looking for it and says, I want no part of this.
Yes.
I mean, do we ever find out who he's trying to sell it to, or is it assumed that he's going to sell it to the collector?
He's going to sell it to the collector, because when they have that scene later with Yondu, and he's like, well, who was going to buy it off of you? That's when he finds out it was the collector he was going to sell to, which also
I was uncertain, because he doesn't mm-hmm. show up at what was the name of the place? No something or other?
Nowhere.
He doesn't show up to Nowhere until Peter Quill basically calls him on the radio right before diving out into space. So
it wasn't
clear to me there.
He was on the station right before everything went down. They show him and his Ravagers start walking like a hallway or something.
Right.
Yeah, that's all they do, though. Like, they don't make a deal out of the fact that he's on the station. He doesn't go talk to the collector.
It's assumed
that's all that happens.
At least for me, it's assumed that the collector is going to be working with Ronan or Thanos eventually anyway. So the fact that the dealer is going to sell to the collector, who is going to give to Ronan or Thanos, just it doesn't make sense that the dealer is then freaked out once the name comes out, because he already knows what's going on, unless the collector just lied to him really well and hid the fact that he just wants it to give to Thanos.
But he doesn't want it to give to them. He wants to collect it. It's not just a clever name.
I didn't really necessarily believe that, because we have so little explanation of his character beyond his name that, you know, he didn't seem heartbroken that all of his stuff flew out of glass cases everywhere. He didn't seem like he was chasing it down or brokenhearted that stuff was running away. So,
did you not see the end scene?
Yeah, I saw the end scene. It was stupid.
Mm-hmm. But anyway he was drinking his problems away. But I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Right. So then they have this roundabout where they're all trying to capture either Peter Quill or the sphere. So him, Gamora, Groot, and Rocket are running around this little town square trying to beat each other up or capture each other. And then eventually the police show up and arrest them all and throw them in maximum security prison
mm-hmm.
for tasering each other. I don't know why. Because they all have criminal records from the past?
In the scene they go through all of their criminal records, but then they also know that Gamora is a daughter of Thanos. So it makes a little sense why she goes to maximum security prison. It doesn't make any sense why Peter Quill or Groot or Rocket are going to maximum security prison.
Maybe they have a two strikes rule, because they mentioned that they picked up Peter Quill before, and now this is his second strike. He's going straight to maximum security prison.
Yes. Well, and they also had like a weird line, like right when they get to the prison, where Rocket's like, oh, well, some of the Nova Corps are corrupt and these are the corrupt ones. And I was listening to that. I was like, that's kind of a throwaway weird line. Like, I don't know why you'd say that unless you felt like you needed to justify the fact that you guys just went to maximum security prison. But
there was a lot of talking while they were walking down a hallway toward prison with guards who weren't actually looking at them, which was odd.
It didn't bother me very much. What bothered me more, I think, is how easily they set up the alliance where they'll keep each other alive because they want to collect the bounty on him. And nobody cares about Gamora, but Peter secretly cares about Gamora.
Yeah, this is where this is where it turned into a PG-13 movie for me really quick, because they all just became, let's all be friends because friends are the best thing in the world. And I understand that maybe that's how this group has to get together, because they're a group or whatever, and they have to have tension in the beginning, or they have to overcome that or something. But they definitely go from, we're all trying to kill or capture each other, to, we're in this together, so let's look out for each other, which wasn't really justified, and it's whatever. Unless you just want to go with Chris Pratt thought Zoe was hot, and he wanted to keep her alive because whatever.
Well, see, I can give that a little bit of a pass, because he does seem to have a romantic interest in her, but and Rocket and Groot certainly don't seem to care about her or whether or not she gets killed. Because
they just care that she knows somebody who's willing to buy the orb for 4 billion units, if I recall.
Yeah. And in fact, they didn't want to get involved when she was going to get slashed up by Drax. And Peter, you know, got himself involved, which then gets them involved. If anyone really made no sense, it was Drax. He walks back his whole, like, I'm gonna destroy you. Maybe not. Then I can get close to Ronan. Like,
he's another symptom, I think, of the whole PG-13 thing, because he's more of a plot device than a character. He's this, like, infantile, aw shucks, everything I take literally, and I'm honest to a fault, including in this little jokey way with my vocabulary, but he's just there to literally flip-flop the second somebody shows him any sort of emotion, or, you know, I lost my friends and family, and that's your fault, but now you're my friend, so I love you. It's just, it was idiotic. But again, I can't speak to how much of this is actually part of the story, because
I don't think this is literally from any story. But the for Drax, I can give his quirky speech patterns and all that stuff like a pass. But yeah, I do agree that he sort of propels things into action in certain ways that are forced for what should be unfolding.
And the quirky speech pattern thing is, like I was talking about with the way they just sort of cut off every scene, the way they take the seriousness and then they throw a joke in at the end because it's supposed to be fun. It's like his goofy little speech thing is something funny to laugh at to completely distract you from the fact that everything he just said seriously a minute ago was complete nonsense.
Well, but see, that's the thing, is like with this movie as a whole, it's one of those things with Marvel where it's like the funny haha action stuff they're good at, and then the serious stuff they're not super good at. And so it only sounds annoying when they say the funny thing to cap the end of something serious, because then it just underscores how the serious thing wasn't really that serious at all. Because it's another one of those things where it's like, whenever he has his serious thing about his wife and his daughter, it's undermined by the fact that he doesn't really seem that shaken up by it most of the time. It just is like a little switch that flips on, and then turns back off again. And so his seriousness I have a hard time with, and I think that a lot of the things that happen in the plot happen because he needed to do them in order for them to happen a certain way.
Totally. And I felt the exact same thing with Gamora and Nebula. They're like, you know, we hate our dad, look what he did for us. And then it's like, okay, run away, you're clearly not tethered by all that much.
Yeah,
but the stuff that bothers me is, it felt like you're saying, with the quirky action they're good at and the seriousness not so much, it felt like the writer was sitting in the chair next to me, sort of like Mystery Science Theater 3000, like yelling jokes at his own serious script. Like, there would be a serious part and he would go like, I know, right, what a goober. And then that would be in the movie rather than somebody like mocking it outside. But they decided to put it in so the people in the audience couldn't do it. But it was just repeated and it kind of drove me nuts. But we should progress through this.
Yeah, I think we digressed there. And I will just say it's kind of like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing where it's like the serious mixed with the comedy stuff, but it doesn't always work. All right, so for the fact that they escape from the prison, I actually found it absolutely hilarious in that one long camera shot where they're just focused on them talking about their plan to take the prosthetic leg, the battery, and the wrist thing from the guard, and that while he's saying how it's absolutely important that they get the battery thing last, Groot's just wandering back into the background and grabbing the battery thing. And so that's one of those things where I think the comedy really works in the film, because I like the way that shot was composed. I thought it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It you know, it shows that they're not really that good at this. They still managed to pull it all off anyways. And of course, the fact that they didn't really even need the prosthetic legs and it was all just a joke anyways was pretty amusing to me. And it got a good laugh in the theater I was in. And I know that's one of those things where you probably would hate that because it's undermining the seriousness of the moment.
That part was funny. That was a joke that I thought worked. I was waiting just like everyone else to see what he was going to do with this leg, and then he was just laughing like, no, I was messing with you.
Yeah.
But yeah, that shot was great, as you mentioned. And it again made me really like Groot because he's got this sort of childlike simplicity to him, but he's also a likable and sympathetic character. He's probably, him and Peter Quill were probably my two favorite characters in the whole thing, which is weird because Groot was entirely CG, but you know, he had very expressive CG eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did a good job with the wateriness of his eyes. But the one thing with the escape that didn't really make a whole lot of sense was that apparently there's a button you can flip that detaches the module thing, but whatever. Yeah. So they get out of there, and then they go get their stuff, and then he needs his mixtape, but they do the thing where they show that he knows how to do the switcheroo, where he looks in the bag and sees the sphere, and then, you know, closes the bag, and we cut to another angle so we don't see the fact that he took out the sphere before
which
he hands
will be
it
relevant
to,
later. Yes. Pay attention to that plot point now.
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing really happens for... they do everything in this movie at least twice. Like the prosthetic leg joke comes up again too. So they go through the whole thing, and he goes and he gets his mask, and they get his ship, and they're waiting outside, and he goes out to meet them. And we see that he can survive for whatever temporary amount of time with his gear, which is, of course, another important plot point that will come up later.
Also completely absurd, but sure.
Yes. Well, I don't understand the hair thing. Because
apparently all you gotta do is hold your breath and you can survive in space.
Well, the mask thing, like, apparently was there to help, but it wasn't a mask that covered his whole head. So it didn't really,
maybe he's got one of those little James Bond things that to breathe underwater, you know, the little thing that looks like a pen.
Well, it covered his mouth, so I thought that was what it was doing, but just the fact that it doesn't cover his head, it's like his head's still gonna like freeze off and like still a huge
pressure
because
it's pressurized. Yeah.
Well,
his eyeball. Maybe the mask holds his eyeballs in too.
Yeah. So anyway, so they go to the ship, and then they're all like, "Oh well, let's skedaddle, kids." And then we get the whole stupid scene with Thanos on the asteroid.
You skipped an important plot point.
Oh, what an important plot point?
Which was Rocket building a Hadron something gun.
Oh, I thought he did that when they cut back after the asteroid.
No, I thought that was like right as soon as he got out. He showed up on the ship and said, "What are you doing disassembling my ship?" And he was building a... I thought it was a little on the nose again to use Hadron in the name of it, but sure, whatever. We get that it's going to be a big, powerful atomic thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Right. Now if we have put a Hadron Collider on the shelf in the first act, we are going to use that again in the third act.
Well,
as the old phrase goes.
Okay, yes. And so we get the dumb asteroid scene. I didn't like the scene on the asteroid at all because we don't really care about Thanos at all. He doesn't do anything. He hasn't done anything in any of the previous Marvel movies. He shows up and gives a little smile thing at the end of the Avengers movie.
In which, I might mention, he looked 10 times more realistic than he did in this movie.
I don't really mind. It didn't bother me that much. It bothers me more about what he says and does than the way he looks.
Fair enough. Yeah, he just sits in a chair and doesn't move. But yeah, that was the one VFX criticism I was going to make, is that he seemed to be a character akin to the Hulk in Avengers, and I thought he was much less successful, which seemed odd because it's been a couple of years since we did Avengers, so I figured, you know, that would have, that process and technology would have gotten a little bit better, but I did not buy and or enjoy looking at Thanos.
Okay, well, he didn't talk in Avengers. He just smiles.
Right.
Yeah, so that's probably why you think that works better, because he didn't
like he was made out of jelly or something. He didn't look...
I don't know if that was all prosthetic or something in that first one, but I think it was performance capture in... all performance capture for his stuff in this movie. It was Josh Brolin doing it, and I didn't mind that he just sits in the chair and talks. That doesn't really affect me very much. What affects me is the fact that he doesn't really... He tries to sound intimidating, but he has no way of enforcing any of this intimidating stuff.
He's intimidating because in an earlier scene we heard he's the most powerful being in the universe or something.
Yeah, but that's another thing where it's like show, don't tell.
Right.
It's kind of dumb. Like, it's inconsequential. Like, the whole reason why he's there is just to set up the fact that he will be there in following Marvel movies.
It's like, is he more powerful than that gigantic being that was in the Infinity Stone flashback that, like, destroyed an entire planet? Because that thing looked kind of intimidating.
That was a Celestial.
Okay.
And I don't know the answer to that question, actually. But the scene's also kind of a waste because Nebula's there and has a chance to interact with her father, who she might have problems with. It's not really clear at this point in the movie because she doesn't betray him until later on, but she has no interaction with him, really. She's just sitting there fiddling with her arm, and Ronan kills the other guy who was from the Avengers movie, so good job being there for 2 minutes. And
a bad guy is serious when they kill their own henchmen to show you how tough they are.
I know. God. It's one of those cliches that I detest at this point. Like, it was cool the first time you saw it happen in, like, you know, Empire Strikes Back. And it's like, oh, well, he choked to death his admiral. That's really cool. And then you think about that for a little while, and you're like, that doesn't really make a lot of tactical sense.
Why would you do that? He probably, like, needed to go pick up your dry cleaning, and now you don't even know where he dropped it off.
I don't think admirals do that. But, but anyway, so it didn't make a whole lot of sense. That whole scene just seems like a waste, because it seems like it's more about the fact of having Thanos in your movie than it is about having anything about Thanos impact your movie. Because the only other time we see him is later on as a hologram, and he does nothing.
Which case, he would have been just as intimidating as, like, you know, the Emperor in Star Wars, which would have been fine. All we needed was a hologram of him. We didn't need to be in person.
No, we didn't even
Ronan. Ronan needed to be called to the deck because Thanos was apparently mad at him.
Yeah, I mean, but he didn't even need to do that. Like, if they weren't going to have him interact with any of these characters in any real sense, then don't have him in the movie. I mean, he's in the movie just to establish the fact that he will be in future movies, which seems like a waste, because they could have used that time more effectively in other places.
In this movie, he feels like a sort of like a psychopathic Buddha. He just sits there and smiles creepily at people while he's apparently doing all of these underhanded things that we don't see.
Yeah. But then we also have... you know, they're going to go to nowhere, and they show up there, and it's the head of a decapitated Celestial that they're mining. And it's an interesting set piece, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense, so I don't really care. But it's one of those, it's very clear that their version of an outer space galaxy kind of thing is more like, you know, the heavy metal comic books of, like, the 70s than it is, like, you know, a serious thing. Like, it's not gravity or anything. Like, right. We're not really concerned about physics, or we don't care about their mode of transportation. We don't need to know the different warp factors that their ship can travel at. Like, none of this stuff comes up.
Right, the fact that it's a giant, like, open area, but apparently they can walk around with an atmosphere.
Yeah, like...
And they have a balcony looking out into...
Space.
Just standing.
It could be a force field, you never know.
All right, sure. Can we talk about why they were going there?
Yeah.
This is Gamora's betrayal. She's supposed to take the sphere to Ronan, who's going to give it to Thanos, so Thanos will go destroy the Nova Corps people for him. But instead, she quote-unquote betrays him by taking it and selling it to this other guy, who was going to give it to one of them anyway.
No, you don't know that. You're just making that part up.
Okay, a betrayal. This thing I said I was going to get for you, I'm going to go sell it to some other guy.
Yes.
Like, really? Those are the stakes of this movie?
Yeah, well... She says that she will take the money and then go start her own life for herself.
Okay. Yes. I don't buy how that's feasible.
I don't really care. But that's another thing where it's like, it's hard to care about Gamora or Nebula because their motivations don't make a lot of sense. And it's a shame because they're the only two women in the movie, and there are actually two of them in a movie where they could interact with each other about something other than having boyfriends or something. So it's finally time in a Marvel movie for these women to interact, and yet they get like the weakest motivation ever to do things.
And then they fight and then make up or something.
So anyway, so that skips over the part where the collector is seen, his feet are seen anyway, and his assistant is scrubbing a chamber that has a dark elf in it from the Thor Dark World movie, and the whole scary thing is that, oh, the other servant girl was punished, so you want to do like a really good job, use your elbows, and that's supposed to establish him as something, but it seems very vague. And before I saw this movie, I thought the collector was actually supposed to be a bad guy, like an actual person that they like an antagonist they would fight. So it seemed very surprising that he gets so little screen time and all of it is purely devoted to exposition. But again, I skip ahead. They go to the bar. They have to wait for no reason for the collector to call them up to his place, which is apparently right next to the bar. And while they're waiting, several of them get drunk and have a fight, and Chris Pratt and Gamora have a talk about dead parents, and I felt nothing about Gamora's dead parents, but we had seen Peter's mother die at the beginning of the movie, so it was like, okay, that's relatable, so there's some emotion there.
Yeah.
But you totally dropped the ball over here with the other side, with Gamora. It's like, you could have shown something, you could have had some detail about her somewhere, but there's no real sense of an origin for any of the stuff.
Right. They had to gloss over that so they could quickly get to the part where Peter explains who he is and then tries to relate to her by playing his music for her and then tries to dance with her.
And tries to kiss her.
Predictably tries to kiss her, and then she predictably tries to cut his head off.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, that's another one of those moments where it goes from serious to funny, and I saw exactly where it was going from the second they started it, and it was like, okay, can we move on to the next scene now? In which, then we go on to Rocket getting his moment where he has a speech about how he was torn apart and abused and experimented on, and he wants to be respected as an individual and not just a animal or whatever, and blah, 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 speech, 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 and then there's a joke, and then they move on.
Yeah, I don't know what's in that stuff they drank, but it was like truth serum.
Yeah, it was idiot juice is what it was. It's not just alcohol. They became moronic.
Yeah, well, because then after that dumb fight, Drax wanders off and then drunk texts Ronan.
to basically say, I hate you. I have that thing you're looking for. Come fight me, bro.
Yeah, come at me, bro. And so that was just ridiculous. And
for somebody who he really wants to kill Ronan, he's apparently waited his whole life to kill Ronan. He apparently knows nothing about Ronan or how tough he is or whatever. So he's just standing there by himself with his two little knives like, this will be all I need. Like, wouldn't you think he would know maybe what he's in for?
No, he's stupid.
clearly.
Well, and that's another thing where it's like Drax's serious moments are completely undermined by the fact that he's just there to move the plot along. His serious moments aren't that serious.
Yeah, which we'll get back to in just a minute once we talk about the collector scene after this.
Oh, God, the collector scene. I hated it so much. It was ponderous. Like, they show up, and he's like, let me tell you all about this thing. It's like, you really shouldn't do that. Why would you do that? Like,
exposition dump, but, you know, he's got this machine that's going to decode the Rubik's Cube of this sphere so it'll open up, which later we find out all you can do is just tear it in half and it does the same thing.
Well, I mean, but Ronan's super powerful, so.
Apparently.
Yeah, I mean, he can tear it in half, but I don't think Peter could. Anyway, so they open the thing, and he's going on with his holograms about how this little rock will destroy everything. And how it's super powerful, and how sometimes people can hold on to it, like, for a moment if they're all, you know, super powerful.
Yes, that story out of nowhere about, for some reason, a group of people tried one time, but they weren't strong enough, because holy crap, do we need that foreshadowed more.
Yeah, well, that's important, and the celestial part's important, like, I mean, but it's all because it's all important, like there's no extraneous information that is imparted through this process, that it seems very suspicious that it won't all come back into play later. And when he goes over to his desk to like, oh, let me pay you now after you know that it's worth more.
To which he just opens a drawer.
Yeah, it's just like, this seems ridiculous. And then the slave girl's like, oh, I'm not going to be your slave anymore. Her plan seemed not very well thought out because she grabs onto the thing and explodes.
Yeah, the end of that scene was so weird because it's like he's explaining this, we're seeing the reactions, and they keep cutting to the slave girl. I'm like, why do they keep cutting to this girl? What is the point of this? And then they cut over to that weird sort of like angular shot of him opening the drawer, and I'm looking at the drawer. I'm like, is he gonna like pull out a gun and shoot them all and like double cross them? And that's what I was thinking. And then All of a sudden the pink girl grabs the thing and explodes, and it's like, what was that?
Yeah,
like they go from serious scene to then Rocket going, yeah, blah, 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 give me money, because they have to end every scene on a joke. And then she explodes, and it's like, okay, we're done now.
I thought that was kind of ridiculous.
Building explodes, but Peter and Gamora are fine because they hid behind a desk.
Yeah, duck and cover.
Right.
But the that's another thing where that's clearly there because they need to show that if you're not powerful enough and you hold on to this thing, you'll explode. Because they want that to seem perilous because they want that to be risky later.
Stakes.
Yes, I know. And so that's silly. And then Ronan shows up.
With Nebula.
And they're going to go get the thing.
And a bunch of Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Well, it made no sense. Because Ronan stays to fight the guy. And it's like, he doesn't obviously need to stay there for any reason at all. He could just knock him out of the way and get on the ship, but apparently he wants to do this. It's more important than getting the rock thing.
I mean,
and
Nebula for an egotist, I kind of buy that he just wanted to show this guy what's up for a minute, which was fine because he wasn't mm-hmm. harmed by it at all. But yeah, it was a little like, why are you even wasting your time if the thing is over there?
Yeah, but we also see like Yondu's on the station somewhere, and you know, is going to theoretically head towards the collector, and he doesn't really seem fazed by the fact that the whole place is under attack. But whatever. And they all steal these construction pods, and there's this cool little scene where they're all flying around the place that doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it's kind of neat because it's kind of like the inside of the Death Star or something with all the construction that seems perilous. And then they, you know, go out into space, and Gamora gets shot, and they take the little rock thing, and Nebula
leaves.
I did think
it was funny the way he puts his construction pod inside one of the other pods and uses his little claw things to grab the shooters to blast the other guys. That was clever,
novel.
And yeah. Funny for a moment, but yeah, then they go out into space, like you're saying, and Gamora gets blown up out of her ship, which they did it in a slow motion dramatic way that's like, wow, she's dead now. We're all just sitting here watching her float around in space. But no,
it's slow motion.
You
don't die in slow motion.
There's one line that if you would cough, you would miss, where Rocket goes, thanks to her body modification, she'll survive for a little bit longer than a regular human being, but not much. It's like, come on, do you have to do that?
It's, and then, you know, Peter's going to save her, because, of course. And the way he goes about saving her doesn't make a lot of sense, because the first thing they tell you on your aircraft is you put the mask on yourself first before you put the mask on.
And then as he's diving out of the ship, Rocket is still talking to explain to us what's happening, that you can't fit two people in there. These things aren't fit to be in space. So we know that he can't grab her and go back in the pod and save her. He has to hang out in space with her, in which case he takes a deep breath with his mask on, turns off his mask, and puts it on her so she can start breathing. Which, again, breathing in space means you explode. So whatever. This whole thing where they're trying to explain that she'll survive for a little while because she's been genetically modified by Thanos, like, whatever, just stop right there, because apparently according to this movie the only thing that happens when you jump out into space with your breath held is you start to freeze and turn into icicles.
Well, not turn into icicles, you start to get frosty, and then when you go back inside you're fine, because they didn't have any frostbite, because they get immediately abducted by Yandu's abduction beam, and so they're all on board abducted. And he's going to kill Peter for betraying him and trying to get off with the money. And then Peter talks him into, like, oh, well, you could have all of this cash if you just follow Gamora and I. We have, like, our little plan thing here. We're going to walk you through. And then they cut to the Drax shooting Yondu ship with the special bullet thing, and they're threatening to blow them all up, and Peter calls them off, and they get on the ship, and he's like, oh, I wouldn't have saved us, you're gonna blow us all up.
And that scene was there because the other guys in the crew had to show up and get back together with their gang, but they couldn't just have them like knock on the door and be like, hey, can we come too?
Yeah, well, they need to have the Ravagers go along because they need them for the stuff that happens later. And they need to have all of our main cast get back together and realize that they need to work better as a team. And then
we have one of the dumbest scenes in the entire movie where they literally sit around and talk about what they're going to do and figure out the plot basically in real time.
Yeah. I didn't mind that as much. It was kind of like an Ocean's 11 kind of a thing.
The part that I minded was Peter Quill going, damn it, we're screwed. And he puts his head down and his hand up to his face and turns his back to the group and walks away. And they go, wait, I will stand with you. And then they all stand up and say their dramatic speeches. And then, of course, there's a joke at the end of the scene where Rocket says, okay, we're all standing now. Is that the point?
I actually kind of like that.
That was, again, I laughed. There a lot of these little funny jokes they throw in are funny, but like I was getting fatigued by this point. Like every single scene is serious and then a stupid joke that takes the piss out of what they just said immediately after.
Yeah, but I didn't mind because I didn't think any of the serious stuff was that serious. So,
but then, like, what are we watching? It's like this neutral gray feeling through the entire movie, and it's just...
Well, see, that's the thing, is like the comedy is good. The seriousness is... I'm ambivalent towards, because I don't think they execute serious stuff very well. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they punctuate the scene with a joke. If you took the joke out, that scene would still not be a very good serious scene. Like, the stuff they say when they're being serious is utterly ridiculous. Yeah. And
like
so,
I said, it felt like the writer was sitting in the chair next to me making fun of his own movie, and then they just put that in the movie. And I don't know, that just felt weird to me.
Well, James Gunn did help write it. It didn't bother me, but then we get the whole thing of, like, Ronan going, oh, I'm going to use the magical power rock, and you can't have it. And,
and screw you, like, Thanos, I don't need you anymore, because now the sphere that I was fetching for you, I had no idea what it was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could understand that part of not understanding what the sphere was, except the fact that you'd think that it would be important enough if you actually examined it.
Like, and if a guy of Thanos' stature is asking you to fetch a thing for him before he will destroy a world for you, wouldn't you maybe go, like, what is it? Yeah, it's probably important.
It necessitated a Google search or two. So anyway, so he gets the thing, and he puts it into the hammer thing, and it's like hammer time, and, you know, he's like, screw you, I'm not talking to you anymore, and he hangs up on him. Of which there are no repercussions for him. Like, as scary and awful and horrible as Thanos is, nothing happens because of this.
He's just apparently the smiling Buddha, because apparently it seems like he knows what is going to happen in every Marvel movie up until his movie, and he's just like, you know what, I'm gonna sit back and wait for my movie because I don't need to do anything right now, because apparently I know things that nobody else knows.
Yeah, I mean, I was arguing with someone on Twitter when I was saying I had some story problems, and I mentioned this is a story problem, was like, there literally needs to be, there's no reason for Thanos to do anything. They were saying, well, he just knows that it's going to fail, and then he's going to go in and scoop up the stuff. Like, you don't know that wouldn't happen. And I was like, well, that's kind of pretty flimsy, because he doesn't indicate that at all.
We know he's powerful, but do we know that he's, like, all-knowing or something?
No, it's seems sketchy at best.
As best we're aware, he has no knowledge of anything that has happened in this movie aside from the two phone calls from Ronan and the fact that he showed up. Like, yes. He has no idea what's going on with Peter or Gamora or Drax or any of that.
Nope. And so, you know, the whole thing with, like, Korath saying, oh, you're gonna go against Thanos? That's crazy. And he's like, well, it's not that crazy. Join me. And he's like, okay, fine. And then Nebula's like...
the flip-flopping sides of this movie. Everybody does it when they get captured by... what's his name? The guy who raised him, and then they flip-flop. Yeah, Yondu. There's like, well, I'm gonna kill you. Nope, now I'm not gonna kill you anymore. And it's like, every character in this does that. And again, it's just over and over. And it's like, what am I even watching anymore? Okay, so we're getting on. They have their plan now. They're going to...
Oh, you missed the part where Nebula says, I would do anything to... I would destroy hundreds of worlds if it meant you know, screwing over Thanos. And it's like, well, you didn't make that at all clear earlier in the film. Like, none of your actions up until this point indicated that you did not like that guy.
Yeah, if you didn't like him, like, use your inn as his stepdaughter to, like, sneak up and stab him while he's sleeping or something. Like, do what normal people do when they're pissed off at their stepdad.
I don't know if that's really normal.
normal psychotic people with robotic arms.
Okay, yeah, this must be more of an Arizona thing. So
only the west side.
Yeah, no,
it's a local joke.
And so then we get the whole thing of, like, they're telling John C. Reilly, hey, it's super important. Like, just so you guys know, this bad thing's going to happen. And he goes and he tells Glenn Close, and they have their funny little haha moment where he's like, he says, and I'm quoting here, he's an asshole, but, you know, he's not a dick. And
he's not 100% a dick.
Yes, not 100% a dick.
Which is only there to set up the line later that, hey, they got my dick message.
Yes. But I did laugh at that because I'm juvenile enough to laugh at such
a
thing.
Like I said, there are a lot of those moments that are funny like that, those little lines that they throw in at the end of the scene, but they're setting up the joke with serious business, and then they're just undercutting it with a joke. But anyway, so yeah. I
must have watched too much Buffy the Vampire Slayer because I'm actually clearly fine with most of these.
I didn't watch any Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But so they're going to go stop... I just spaced. They're going to go stop Ronan because as soon as he touches the ground, everyone will die. And they sent their message in the hopes that the government will help them out. And I was unclear as to whether or not it was the ship touching the ground, his foot touching the ground, or his little spear thing touching the ground that would kill everyone, right up until the point where he walks off and he tries to jam his little dude head into the ground. But I'm jumping ahead for a moment. So their plan is to, again, they sort of hint at it because they apparently know exactly what Ronan's going to do. He's going to go into lockdown mode, and Gamora's going to sneak on because she knows the ship, and she's going to disable the force field, and then they're going to shoot him with this thing that Rocket made out of his ship, the Hadron Enhancer, whatever the hell it was called. And apparently that's supposed to kill him.
Yes. But
so
we get the whole scene of the Dark Aster ship going into the atmosphere. It doesn't make a lot of sense because he could just
fly
down in it.
Very big atmosphere, by the way. Very, very big atmosphere.
He could just fly down in a little tiny ship on the other side of the planet. If it kills everything on the planet, does it really have to be the capital city?
Right. Why wouldn't he just, like, distract them with the big ship and just, you know, take a detour?
Yeah. I mean, and do you really want them to see you coming so that they all flee? Like, I thought you wanted to kill all of them. Just surprise them.
Yeah, again, and that's the one I give him a little bit of a pass because he's a psychotic egotist and he can be like, look at me, behold, I'm going to destroy you. Even freaking Drax even says behold at one point in this movie.
Yeah, but I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, tactically, nothing he does makes much sense. He's very slowly going into the atmosphere, directly over the Capitol, because that's the best place to do it. And then the Ravagers are going to meet him in space over the thing with their ships, and they fire the thing that explodes and gives them cover to swoop underneath. And it's like, that's kind of, you didn't spell that out before me beforehand, so that was kind of neat that you did that.
Right, but literally the only person looking out the window to see them coming was Nebula.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I can't see past this fire. Nobody else in this giant ship can probably see anything because I guess we don't have like radar or anything else. But yeah, I can't see.
Oh, it was
so
a
they're
giant,
waiting for
giant,
me to yell out.
It was a giant energy explosion, so they probably couldn't directly sense what was happening in front of them, maybe.
Right. But there was only one person who doesn't actually have a full-time job on this ship, but she was the one who was doing the lookout to let them know the bad guys were coming. But sure, whatever.
Yeah. Well, they have those four guys manipulating the sphere controls that, I don't know, adjust the air conditioning.
What the literal hell was that? Like, they're just four guys manipulating a sphere to make a ship go from up high to down low.
I thought, I will say this for it. It looked neat. It made no sense, but it looked neat. Because if I really wouldn't have wanted to see them sitting at like Star Trek style consoles, like pushing buttons, because I think that would have been kind of boring. But seeing them do the sphere thing, like if you think about that for more than 5 seconds, you're like, I don't know what you're doing. And you don't seem that phased by what's happening inside of the room. So obviously you're not paying much attention.
It also seems like a guy of Ronan's stature, who's apparently got his own force behind him, he has like four employees that work for him. Like, it's just him and like a couple other dudes.
Well, he has more because they man the little, they call them necroplasts or whatever, the little fighter ship things.
Yeah, the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, but one of the things I thought was weird is at the beginning of the, and this is, might sound nitpicky, like a technical nitpicky kind of a thing, is like at the beginning it says like it's a Kree warship, but then it's clearly not staffed by any Kree. There's just Ronan, and then there's some yellow people that put the makeup on, and then we never see them again. And there's Nebula and Korath, and then it's all the rest of them are the Sakaarans, who we don't hear them referred to as Sakaarans until the one scene where they're preparing for battle on the Ravager ship, and the one Ravager says, oh, well, what are we going to do? Would they have like a whole army of Sakaarans? And Drek says, oh, I prefer to think of Sakaarans as paper people. And I actually kind of laughed at that because it's sort of an inside joke about the fact that all of the henchmen in these Marvels movies, you know, you can shoot them once and they fall over dead. They are paper people. It is a little on the nose again. And like their fighter ships are not that skilled and don't seem that coordinated and don't go around and shoot the Nova ships very well.
Were these supposed to be the same bad guys that were in Avengers?
No, they're different. Those were the Chitauri, who were the sort of like mummy insect looking things. And these ones are the sort of turtly looking ones, but with like a, we see a close up on one of their mouths when they're down on the surface later.
Right, but
that's the only time we see anything that hints at what their internal structure is like. The rest of the time, they're just armored.
Yeah, in that close up, they were actually sort of frightening looking characters. But yeah, the rest of it, they just looked like Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like not to digress too much here, but have you ever seen Galaxy Quest?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, the bad guys in Galaxy Quest, because they had such a limited budget, they had like full animatronic heads for two of the bad guys, and then they had like one face part for one of the like head henchmen, and then the rest of them were all in full battle gear of just armored head to toe, and like even their guns were armored for whatever reason, and they kind of look like the Sakaarans do a little bit. So it's like one of those budgetary tricks where you can make your money go further if you just show a couple of little moments of what's underneath the armor, but then the rest of the time you just show armor.
Yeah, and this movie absolutely had that. Can we talk for a minute about the director's brother,
Sean Gunn?
Yeah, in the scene where Peter is talking to Yondu and convincing him not to kill him, he's like standing next to him and he's got his spiky silly hair or whatever, and he's just making like growling angry face because the boss is angry, I'm gonna be angry. And then you can tell just it's coverage because they're listening to Yondu talk. Every time they cut back, even though Yondu is changing his mind, he's got this like angry like, ah, I'm gonna kill Peter face. And then at the very end, they're like, he's like, well, I guess we won't kill you now. And then they're all like, yay, they all cheer. But he's just standing next to Chris Pratt, that whole scene, with this stupid, angry, like, painted-on makeup face with stupid spiky hair and just, like, making this dumb, angry background guy face. And then eventually he smiles and goes, yay, whatever, whatever, we're going to be rich or something. And then they move on. And it was just like, I know I'm, you know, most people aren't going to look away from Chris Pratt in the center of the frame, but these other four guys that are around him clearly had no direction. They look like background players that are just way too close to the camera for having no direction, and they were just distracting and annoying to me.
I didn't mind them because I thought the Ravagers were all incompetent, so it fit that everybody would be kind of sort because they're kind of like redneck hillbilly kind of people, basically, especially with Yondu. Like, that's a little on the nose. They're not very sophisticated foes, so it didn't bother me. Like, if he had been speaking like Oxford English the entire time and like, you know, had a monocle or something, and then that was the face he was making, then it would have stuck out a little more.
They just seemed more two-dimensional than they needed to be.
I didn't mind. He was such a background nothing that it didn't really matter.
Right, which is why it bothered me that he was so close to the frame and he had the same amount of space in the frame as Chris Pratt. And I was just staring at him going like, why are you making that face? Is that what you call quote-unquote acting? Anyway, let's move along to the battle.
Yeah. It didn't make a lot of sense, the motivation of the Ravagers for risking their lives as much as they do for how cowardly they turn out to be later.
What are you talking about, risking their lives? Yondu gets shot down and he gives this, I'm going down, brother, speech, and then he's fine on the surface, and then he kicks a bunch of people's asses anyway.
Well, that's just because his life was threatened.
but like, he gives his Porkins, I'm going down, and then like he's fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the safety features on your whatever it is
on your intergalactic spaceship,
yeah, you know, the airbags and stuff, but the and he lands in a park. But the whole thing of the battle, at least they didn't keep doing the same exact thing over and over again, but they did keep cutting back to Nova Prime doing absolutely nothing, and telling
like,
them
this battle looks a little bit too much like Independence Day. Quick, everyone form a fake net.
Well, then that didn't make a lot of sense.
No,
because but I was willing to give some of it a pass, but it did go on for an awfully long time, and it didn't seem like they were trying all of their possible solutions against the net. So
and here's the problem that bugged the crap out of me. Okay, so Ronan is in his little sealed off room, so nobody can hurt him because he's got to make it down to the ground. But then to get through this net, he like opens a window and just like points his stick at him and they all blow up. It's like, you have that power and you're like afraid and you're hiding behind a force field? Like, what are you doing? You're this strong. Why are you hiding from anyone ever?
Well, he doesn't want people getting in and messing up the four guys that use the little silly orb things.
Well, like, lock them in there and go outside or something. Like, you are the biggest weapon here, and you're, like, you're just sitting back and waiting for your moment.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing when I say that it went on a little too long, was that clearly he had the ability to do something to circumvent the ridiculous barricade net thing.
But did he not know that? Like, he put the thing on his stick, and he's suddenly powerful enough to destroy a whole planet, but he's vulnerable enough for these four dinguses that are sneaking in and all of these ships that he locks himself down. Like, what?
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, it just went on too long. Like, if that was a minute, then it wouldn't have been like a big deal. But the fact that it went on for like 10 minutes,
it's still a big deal though. Like, why did he even have the inclination to hide? He's like all powerful now.
He's not hiding though. Like, he's just in his command room. He thought it would all be taken care of by the other guys. Like, he says, oh, this has gone on too long. Tell Yondu to call off his Ravagers.
But and I didn't buy that plot point of like locking it down and Gamora had to break the force field so they could get in and shoot him. Like, why is he even locking it down? Like, if I was that strong, I'd be like, come and get it. Show up in my ship. I'll kill you. Don't care.
Well, but not everyone on his ship and not his ship itself are invulnerable, as we see. Like, they can clearly be damaged. And there is apparently some very vital equipment inside that room because one ship takes out the whole thing.
Right.
You know, Return of the Jedi style.
Right.
But
so once he opens a window to destroy the net, in comes Rocket.
Yeah, and so it's one of those things where it's just like, I can buy letting the net thing go on for like a minute. Like, you don't want to dirty your hands or whatever. You're just going to have your like employees take care of it. But the fact that it kept going on, it's like, you really should have just stepped in at that point and blown them all up, instead of waiting another 9 minutes for them to just sit around and do nothing. And the whole thing with Korath didn't make any sense, because I never found him threatening from the instant he was introduced. So when he's in the hallway with his guys, it's like, all right, he's dead. And sure enough, he's dead. It was not a big fight scene.
I did expect them to do a Galaxy Quest thing there, because if you notice, the background of the set was like big pistons moving or whatever. I was waiting for him to get kicked in and like crushed underneath it, but whatever. They did the callback to the joke with Drax taking the finger across the neck too seriously, but that's fine. Mm-hmm. So there was the battle, and then they break in with the mythical Hadron Collider gun and shoot.
Yeah, and predictably, it does nothing.
It does nothing.
I never thought it was.
Predictably, they go, "You did it." No, you didn't.
Did you think it was going to do anything? I didn't.
No.
From the instant they said this plan, I was like, "There's no way that that's going to do it."
Which is why I found it hilarious that they were celebrating when they hit him with a spaceship.
Yeah,
and they thought that killed him.
Yeah. Well, and that was also another thing that's like Galaxy Quest, because then when the ship crashes, he crawls out.
Yeah, he just walks out. He's like, "Well, here I am." Thanks for getting me to the ground quicker, apparently, by breaking the ship than just flying it.
I mean, he could have jumped out the window. And since he's invulnerable, like, he would have been fine. He wasn't going to sprain an ankle or anything. Like, he really could have just jumped out and then landed on the surface.
His life's mission is to destroy the Nova Corps people, so why doesn't he just, like, suicide bomb and dive out the window? And even if he died, oh well, he wins.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. It's like, I don't think that would have even killed him. Like, it's pretty clear at this point that he's fine. Like, nothing's going to dent him. So it didn't really make a whole lot of sense that this much emphasis was put on getting this gigantic ship onto the ground.
Right. So the ship's going down. Mm-hmm. We have another touchy sentimental moment because a character is about to die, but not die.
Yeah. And then Groot does his little bush thing. Makes like the little twig ball, like it's Christmas. And he has the little glowy pollen things, and it's sad because he's going to die. Although I had read something in the comics where he had died and was restored from a little twig thing, so I was pretty sure that was going to happen when I was watching the movie.
More than coming back from a little twig, I was like, really? That's going to save these guys in this giant metal ship that's about to crash?
Eh.
He's a stick. That's not very soft.
Well, I mean, but it made like a little bouncy ball thing, like,
sure,
and then it exploded. But it didn't bother me that much. I mean, I just knew that he wasn't really dead. Did you think he actually died?
No, of course not.
Okay.
So, moving on from predictable death and predictable undeath, we have Ronan emerge, and he's going to execute his master plan by monologuing to 20 people who decided to wander up to the gigantic ship that just crashed.
Which was great because we got a line a couple minutes before that, okay, the city's been evacuated. And then we go to outside, it's like, where did all these people come from?
Are they just hanging out nearby? Just they hid in the broker's room because the broker was there. Did you see him in the crowd?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, that's so coincidental. The broker just happened to show up.
The guy who wants nothing to do with Ronan. Yeah, and this is, you know, maybe this is a production thing, but that little town square where they were having their initial, like, where they first met and were trying to capture each other, that was in the ending scene shot from a different angle because they had the set and they didn't want to build another part of the city or something. It felt like the city was very small in terms of what they could actually shoot, and then there were the giant, massive, full CG shots, but the places they actually did things in this city were just that little square, and it felt very small in terms of the production for me. I don't know, but the characters showing up again is the exact same thing.
Yeah, and they had the same mix of a couple of yellow people, a couple of magenta people, a couple of blue people.
Of course.
There are a lot of magenta people in this movie. The thing goes on where he's pontificating about how he's going to end all of their lives, and it's just end them. Like, you don't need to talk anymore. Like, they're not going to appreciate this in like 5 seconds. Just get it over with.
For a violent soldier who just hit a guy in the head with a giant hammer and like rolled around in his blood in the opening scene, you're kind of becoming a stereotypical useless bad guy here in the end because you're about to stab your spear into the ground and you're suddenly distracted by some jackass dancing and singing in front of you.
Yeah, I didn't buy it. I mean, I chuckled a little right when it first happened, but then the scene went on way too long. And by way too long, I mean more than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Because that should not have fazed him enough to just keep talking about what was happening. Like, he shouldn't have like been asking him questions about what he was doing. Like, right.
Had to be long enough for the audience to get the joke, mm-hmm, and then laugh and then quiet down so he can hear him go, "What are you doing?" And I go, "I'm distracting you, you idiot."
Mm-hmm. And then,
which again, this is the writer sitting next to me going, I'm going, "What are you doing?" And the writer literally goes, "He's distracting him. Isn't it funny?" And the character on the screen freaking says, "I'm distracting you." Like,
I was
can you
fine.
Be a little more clever than that? Like a half of an order more clever, but whatever.
It bugged me more that when Drax shot the thing that it knocked the little stone thing out, and then we had the slow-mo shot of them both reaching for it.
Well, of course.
And then, of course, Peter gets it. But then all of a sudden, Ronan is like 20 feet away from Peter as soon as he grabs the stone.
You mean when he grabs it with his right hand and then suddenly it's fused to his left hand? There's a continuity problem there?
Yes. But there's also that huge distance that has increased between the two characters, because then all of a sudden he's standing over near the crowd where Gamora and Rocket and Drax are, and very far away from where our little buddy is, even though he was literally right next to him enough to get the stone. So it was a little nonsensical. And then we had the predictable callback to the exposition we had earlier from the Collector of, you know, people could unite in order to try to manage the power of it. And I didn't think they were going to explode, so I knew that there was going to be some supernatural reason for it. The only nice part was the callback to the hold my hand part, with his mom.
Yeah, like, that was good.
That was good. I give that some... That was a good tie-in because he didn't hold his mom's hand and he regrets it. And so that was nice that you had that moment. And
because otherwise you might expect him to say, no, I got to protect you, so get away from me because I'm going to explode.
Yes. But it's a good thing he didn't do that. And so they all hold hands. Go team. And then they master it and their skin stops peeling and they're fine. And then
they suddenly learn how to shoot a fireball and blow him up.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was in the stone manual. You didn't read the close-up print on it when it was spiraling through the air before he caught it.
Right.
And so they blow up Ronan. Poor schmuck. And then they put the stone into a little sphere thing, and everybody's safe. And then they do the switcheroo, because Yondu shows up, and he's unscrupulous and wants to have the rock in order to sell to someone. It's vague.
Because they're suddenly not on the same team anymore.
Well, yeah, but we knew that he wasn't going to be on the same... Like, Peter even said that back when they were planning. He's like, he's going to want to have the rock. And sure enough, he wants to have the rock. And they, you know, so they do the switcheroo. If you did not know the switcheroo was happening, then I feel very sorry for you as a human being. Because
again, this movie is made for people much younger than us, I think.
Well, it's made for people much younger than us, but they also use some very explicit things in the movie. So I question how much of a
okay, small I should say more naive than us. Is.
Yeah,
He opens the sphere and it's got a troll doll in it, which again is another callback to something they did earlier with Yondu for no apparent reason, where he likes little figurines to line up on his little dashboard.
Because
apparently he's a kitschy hippie from the 70s or something.
Well, and he had. Peter had the troll doll in an earlier scene amongst his personal possessions. And we get the scene with Nova Prime where she's all like, everything's great. And we're like, thank God you're in this movie, Glenn Close. You did nothing.
Well, she puts the rock in like a safe.
Yeah.
Later.
I got a serious question for you. After seeing what the Nova Corps did in this movie, why in the world would you think that they were qualified to hold on to the most deadly weapon that they've ever seen?
Well, just like that phone call she made, the other guy in the other area, he's like, we signed your peace treaty. What do you want us to do? Piss off. Like, you know, it's the political, like, we didn't do anything wrong, so we're just going to back up over here because we're fine. And it's like, well, this stone should have been locked up the whole time, but thank goodness we didn't have to get involved. I guess I could buy it from a lazy politician standpoint, but yeah, they didn't do anything.
Yeah, and we got the weird little throwaway thing of like, oh, your mother was human, but your dad is something very old that we've never seen before. I was like, that's an interesting statement.
Yeah, see, I would have preferred that they would have just said this group had some connection or something, because they are, and we skipped over the fact that they literally say the name of the movie in the movie, which drove me nuts, because they thought they would be clever enough and say, we'll have the bad guy call them Guardians of the Galaxy first, and then they'll call themselves that, and then add the word bitch to it, and then shoot him and blow him up. It's like, okay, you could do the team dynamic thing, and maybe that's why they were strong enough to hold the stone, but you don't have to put the tagline in there, and you don't have to over-justify his worthiness with the stone.
Yeah, but I kind of expect that from this kind of a movie.
Like, yeah, I guess.
It's like a James Bond movie. Like, if they don't say it in the movie, then I'm really disappointed in them. Because it's just sort of... And that gets back to a larger criticism where people are acting like this is some transcendent piece of art house filmmaking. And it's like, no, this is pretty paint by the numbers in terms of what's happening.
Yep.
Like, in terms of other comic book movies that have happened, this is very comic booky. The unusual part is... just the set pieces and the characters being from these races and stuff like that. Like, sure, it's unusual that a talking tree and a raccoon are in a movie and it's successful. And people keep saying that over and over again. Like, oh, they keep having a talking raccoon in a movie and a tree in a movie, and it's so successful. Why can't DC have, you know, a Wonder Woman movie if they can do that? I saw that pop up a couple times on Twitter, and I was just like, well... It's not the same thing, though, because they did a disastrous job, I think, with Gamora and Nebula. It's like, just the fact that the characters are a different species doesn't necessarily mean that the issues that surround comic book movies have been resolved, and that it's some sort of like major art house motion picture all of a sudden, because they were able to make a movie with a raccoon and a talking tree.
Yeah. It is surprising, though, that this movie, again, it's 2 hours long. The plot is pretty thin. Not much happens. They had to cram a lot of characters and a lot of flashbacks and a lot of, you know, back and forth between the characters into it. But essentially nothing happens. The idea of, I'm sure they ran into this in development, which doesn't mean they should have ignored it, but to make everyone a fully justifiable character that does something, that has an arc that's interesting, that's, you know, useful in the story, this movie would probably have to be 4 hours long, and they can't do that because it's a summer blockbuster.
Yeah, but they could have sacrificed flashbacks of what the Infinity Stone does with...
They could have sacrificed a ton of things.
Yeah, they could. There's so much stuff that's in here for telling... so many things are in here to tell the story of things that are not in the movie, things that will be in other movies, that if you eliminated them, you would have found more time for telling what was actually inside this movie.
Yeah, if they would have taken Drax fighting Ronan and getting his butt kicked and then having his little speech after he got thrown in the yellow goop and swapped that for something with Gamora, that would have been great. But then, you know, they wouldn't have had the funny line where Rocket is kicking the grass and then literally says, "I'm so angry, you're making me kick grass," which made people laugh, including me, but again, had nothing to do with anything. It was just another moment where the score got somber and Drax had a speech.
Okay.
But I'm agreeing with you. They should have just excised that whole bit and put something useful in there about the characters who were ostensibly more important than Drax.
Well, but not just more important than Drax, more important than the Marvel stuff that's for other Marvel movies. I think you need to put this movie's storytelling first before you put the storytelling of the franchise
in. Yeah. So that being sort of the transition from the end of this movie to that other topic that you were writing about, is there anything else you want to say about this movie before we talk about Marvel as a whole kind of screwing with these movies?
Thank God Seth Green was a duck.
What? We're going to skip right over that because there's no reason for that to be in here. So idea that this article you sent me was on Polygon about how Guardians of the Galaxy fits into this overarching story that Marvel is trying to tell, where every one of these movies is a piece leading up to this ultimate movie where Thanos gets all of the Infinity Stones from all of these disparate little movies that all relate back to each other and then attacks the universe or Earth or whatever. That all of these are just building up to one movie, and the fact that they're sacrificing standalone movies for the point of making this overarching storyline, as theoretically they kind of do in comic books, and it's kind of making weaker movies. Is that essentially the basic premise there?
Essentially, like, it's just that they could make stronger movies if they weren't as preoccupied with leaning on trying to set up things for the multi-franchise, multi-sequel arcs that they're setting up. Like, the Polygon piece is very in favor of the fact that they're doing that planning. And I feel the opposite, where I think that they need to not lose sight of storytelling and characters, which they could have done a better job at in Guardians of the Galaxy. Like they said a lot of stuff that didn't have anything to do with what happened in the movie. That's just about stuff that's happening later. And they could have used that time to talk about stuff that was actually relevant to Gamora or Nebula or whatever.
Right. Even the stuff that does happen in the movie is so sort of like standard television. Nothing really happens. Like the entire plot of the movie is find the sphere. No, I'm going to sell the sphere and make some money. No, I'm going to take the sphere. And then, well, okay, I have the sphere now. And then, well, no, I took it from you. And that's it. That's like the whole plot. And the problem with that, as you say, is that they're sacrificing standalone movies for this overarching thing that we're not even necessarily sure they're doing. And we have no insight into how well they're going to do it or what the point is until basically we're going to watch 20 movies. And then once we see the 20th movie, we'll go, oh, I get what you were doing this entire time. Now it all makes sense. Like, you're going to sacrifice multiple franchise storylines because you expect us to watch all of these movies, and it'll all make sense in the end because trust us. And we have no idea that that's what they're actually doing or if they're capable of doing that, because this is the first time anyone's ever tried to do such a thing.
Yeah, and I don't discourage them from trying to do such a thing. I just discourage them from putting so much emphasis on it because it could backfire if they don't do it very well. And I think a really good example of that is the Thor sequel. They put a lot of emphasis on things that are not really for that movie. What happens in that movie is you're essentially moving the characters from where they were at the end of Avengers to where they need to be for the next Avengers movie. You're lining things up for other franchises. Like, all that happens is you translate what's happening inside of that film from, so these characters wind up where they need to be for another film. There's nothing in there that's really relevant to the Thor arc of what's happening. Like, the bad guy that's introduced is utterly meaningless, worse than Ronan. The whole mechanism of what the evil weapon is, because again, there's another evil, super powerful weapon that will destroy the universe. That thing turns out to be an Infinity Stone by the end of the movie, which goes to the Collector. It's all leading up to things that are for other things and not about what's happening inside that film. And I really loathe Natalie Portman's character in that movie. And I think Kat Dennings is probably my favorite character in the movie, which is sad because she has the least screen time and has no superpowers whatsoever. And we get Loki, his sort of redemption arc and betrayal. And of course, if you didn't see any of that coming, then I don't know what to tell you. But it doesn't... All that happens, basically, is you have changed things so that these characters will start somewhere else in the next movie, and that's all the movie does. It doesn't... Thor doesn't grow as a human being. As a god, I guess.
He's not a human.
It doesn't improve anything for the Thor arc of what's happening. It just improves things for the next Avengers movie, which is worrisome. And I feel the same way about some of the other stuff. You know, the Tesseract in Captain America was just to set up the Tesseract in the Avengers movie, which is also another Infinity Stone. And so we have the whole thing of, like, now we're just going to have these super powerful stone things showing up in these movies, and it's going to be these characters moving them around as a plot device to get to the next movie. And you have to worry about seeing all of these movies so you understand how these characters get from point A to point B for Thor and Loki to go from where they were at the beginning of the Thor movie to where they end up at the end of the Thor movie, to where they started Avengers, where they ended Avengers, to where they start at Thor 2, where they end at Thor 2, and where that's going to take them for Avengers 2, is like, you're now crisscrossing all this time continuum between all these different movies. It's like a crossover event in a comic book where you need to follow 20 different comic books in order to know what's happening in the crossover event. Like, otherwise you won't understand what's going on if you just follow one of them.
Well, at this point, we know that no matter how many more movies Marvel does, there are 6 Infinity Stones, and they're all going to have to come together at some point. So I think that's the most exhausting part of this whole thing, is that we're going to have to sit through at least 3 more movies where somebody is battling somebody with a glowy rock that could destroy a world, and they have to recover it and then do something with it, which is eventually going to end up going badly, and all 6 of them will come together in some ultra dramatic finale to this sequence, and then presumably they can reboot the whole universe after that.
Well, assuming they make it that far.
Right, but we have to sit through at least 4 more movies. 3 more Infinity Stones, and then the culmination of that.
Actually, it's more than that, because we have there are going to be movies that don't have Infinity Stones or are going to have repeats of the same Infinity Stones. And I say that because they have so many movies that are going right now. They have Avengers, Thor, Iron Man, Captain America, and Guardians of the Galaxy. So that's 5 movies that they have going. They're going to add an Ant-Man movie to that. And they're going to have, each of these things is going to have sequels. So that's 6 movies, and they're going to have their own sequels that will all crisscross each other. And characters and set pieces from movies will appear in other movies of those sequeled franchise things. Like, it's not like they're all on their own little path going forwards.
Right. They have to meet each other at least once, because as we've noted in the Marvel franchises, they have to do everything twice. So they have to meet each other in one of these movies, so then they can get back together in the final movie and fight, presumably, Thanos.
Uh-huh.
apparently there was a rumor that Iron Man was going to make a cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy. Did you see that? But he was removed from the script because it was before he signed his renewal contract.
Sure. I don't know. He's a very popular guy. And they pay a lot of money for him. But that's another thing. Is like Marvel is not immune to casting changes. Marvel is not immune to having bad movies.
I think they're fighting it pretty hard.
Yeah, but they are fighting it pretty hard, and they're paying for it. But at some point, some executive will say, no, this is too much money. We're not going to pay Robert Downey Jr. this. We're not going to pay Chris Hemsworth this. We're not going to pay Chris Pratt this. Not that I think any of them are money-grubbing fools or anything, but when you see the amount of money that these movies make, it's like, well, get whatever you can, guys, because you're living off of being this comic book character for the rest of your life. And, you know, you see the fact that there will eventually be a point where someone gets replaced. It might even be a minor character, like Terrence Howard was replaced. And the Hulk was replaced 3 times.
Well, that was all in the beginning of this quote-unquote franchise universe thing that they're building.
Well, Edward Norton would have appeared as the Hulk originally, but he was such a difficult person to work with that he was recast as Mark Ruffalo. Which I think is fine, because I like Mark Ruffalo fine, but yeah. I think he's better than Edward Norton was, and certainly better than Eric Bana was. But at the same time, you know, we're going to keep having these casting changes. Like, what happens if, unfortunately, something happens to one of these actors and they can't appear in these movies anymore? Like, what if someone gets hit with a car or something like that? Like, some horrible catastrophe happens. Not that I'm hoping anything like that happens, but, I mean, these are realistic things when you're talking about a movie franchise that's going to go on for another 10 years. It's like, sometimes people have unfortunate things that keep them from appearing in movies. Even scheduling conflicts can keep people from appearing in movies. Are you just going to recast that role and say, act like the other guy who was in your role before? I mean, it worked for Dumbledore, but, you know, this isn't, you know, somebody in heavy makeup in a lot of these cases. They're trying to erect these likable characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. It's they've taken on a monumental task with this idea of this arc that spans however many movies it is, 15, 20. And the idea that they're going to keep them all together seems unrealistic. I mean, more power to them trying, because obviously we come to like these characters, and I think at this point the hardest person that they're going to have to hold on to is Robert Downey, because he's been in the most of them. Isn't that correct? Because he's been in all of the Iron Man and then the Avengers, and then we've got more Avengers going on. But, you know, 3 movies for Captain America doesn't sound completely unrealistic, or all these other things. But it's
I mean, what
it's interesting to see what they're doing or what they're trying to do. And I'm not certain how well it's going to turn out, or if the audience is going to get tired of it before they get around to their ultimate final end storytelling universe changing epic movie where everybody fights everybody all at the same time. This movie, as I used before the word, I'm starting to get a little fatigued by the way they're doing these things, because it's cookie cutter. But here's to hoping they've got more in the bag than just swapping out the characters and telling another shiny rock story.
Yeah, shiny rocks.
Oh man, this is a long one.
Yeah, you wanna button this up, because I'm gonna die. The air conditioner needs to turn on.
I'm very sweaty. Yeah. So last thoughts on Marvel? Any of this? Still recommend people go see it?
Yeah. No. I
guess if they've listened this far, they've already seen it, right?
I hope so. I mean, otherwise they're gonna. And even if they have seen it, I'm sure they hate us. sorry, guys. But you know, I think having criticism is still very healthy, and that I don't think it needs to be 100% adulation for the franchise, even if you liked seeing it and would recommend seeing it. And I do recommend seeing it for other people. I think that it'll be great, and that people will have a blast, and dancing Groot at the end of the credits is totally worth it.
Oh, absolutely. That was the best part of the whole movie. I love Groot, but his little dancing thing in the flower pot was great. And yeah, it was a fun movie. I saw it with Amanda. She said she really enjoyed it, and I pried a little bit more as to why, and she said, you know, it's kind of a... It doesn't really need to make a whole lot of sense. It's a fun movie. It's just silly. There were good jokes. And it was, she seemed to think it was a movie made more for people like her who aren't really into comic books or this whole series in general, rather than people like me, which is, as you just mentioned, potentially a fault if she doesn't see all of these movies. But yeah, I don't want to get into the whole pretentious films versus movies thing, but this is definitely a summer popcorn movie. It was fun. It was funny. People should see it because, you know, movies are fun to go see, but there are still problems, and I'm glad we discussed it.
It's not a film unless it's printed on celluloid.
Oh, screw that. The soundtrack's really good, though. I did buy the soundtrack, and I'm going to listen to it.
The Jackson 5 soundtrack.
Yeah, I can't wait till Awesome Mix number 2 comes out, because you absolutely know they're going to release a second soundtrack in a couple months.
Well, I heard that people are putting together their own like mixtapes of the songs on RDO, where they just pick out all of the original songs and it's put together the soundtrack.
The cover art of the soundtrack, which is a square because we used to use CD cover art, has a picture of a tape on a square that would have gone into a CD that is now in my iTunes. So I've got two examples of dead media in my iTunes there.
It's like a turducken of dead media.
Oh, that's good.